From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I asked him, I said, would you like me to come across the line? He said, I would be honored to do that. I would be honored. Now, I didn't know really what he was going to say, but it was my honor to do it. We had a very good meeting.
President Trump made history Sunday when he became the first sitting U.S. president to step foot in North Korea. Trump met North Korean leader Kim Jong-un at the military demarcation line at the Korean Demilitarized Zone Sunday, and then took 20 steps beyond the line, which has divided North and South Korea since 1953. We'll go to Seoul, South Korea, and to Hawaii for the latest. Then over 4 million people fill the streets of New York to celebrate World Pride and mark the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising that launched the modern-day LGBTQ movement. We'll hear voices from the Queer Liberation March.
First, we are honoring our ancestors in the fight for liberation who started this all 50 years ago at the Stonewall Bar.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a historic first for a sitting U.S. president, Donald Trump crossed through the demilitarized zone and set foot in North Korea Sunday, walking side by side with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un after Kim greeted him at the demarcation line. Trump and Kim agreed to resume denuclearization talks, although Trump said sanctions on North Korea would remain for now. North Korea has said in previous negotiations, sanctions relief is a necessary precondition to any sort of deal. The symbolic move came 24 hours after Trump wrote a message on Twitter offering to meet Kim at the DMZ after the G20 summit wrapped in Japan, and 4 months after nuclear talks between the two leaders broke down in February when President Trump walked out of the Vietnam summit. We'll have more on the story after headlines. In Hong Kong, thousands have taken to the streets today, the anniversary of Hong Kong's return to Chinese control 22 years ago. Dozens of protesters breached the legislature building, where they were met by riot police. Protesters continue to call for Chief Executive Carrie Lam to step down over a contested bill which allow for extraditions of Hong Kong residents and visitors to mainland China, which critics see as an infringement on their legal rights and on the independence of Hong Kong. Lam has postponed the legislation but has not fully withdrawn it. The U.S. and China have reached a temporary trade truce after a meeting between President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping Saturday at the G20 summit in Japan. The truce delays a new round of 25% tariffs on $300 billion of Chinese goods. Trump also walked back a recently announced ban on selling U.S. equipment to Chinese telecom giant Huawei. He said China will in return import large amounts of American agricultural products. The Trump administration said, however, no timeline had been set to reach a longer-term trade deal with China. Also, while at the G20 summit, Trump met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, praising him as a reformer and telling him, quote, you've done a really spectacular job. Trump refused to answer questions from reporters about bin Salman's role in the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi last October, but said the prince was very unhappy about the killing. The United Nations, U.S. intelligence officials, and U.S. lawmakers have all found credible evidence that the crown prince was directly implicated in ordering Khashoggi's murder. In Sudan, at least 10 people were killed after tens of thousands took to the streets Sunday, the first mass demonstration since the deadly crackdown on a peaceful protest camp in Khartoum by security forces in early June, which killed at least 128 people.
In Yom Tizar Shiri Ramadan, Since the 29th of Ramadan, I have felt my blood boiling in my veins. So I have to come out tonight. I had to march. I had to march for everyone killed. I had to march for the martyrs that died. March for the girls that were raped. I had to march to achieve something, anything.
Amidst an internet and press blackout, reports emerged of Sudanese police deploying tear gas, live ammunition, and stun grenades into crowds. Demonstrators are continuing to demand a civilian-led government after a months-long popular uprising led to the military overthrow of the long-standing authoritarian President Omar al-Bashir in April. In Afghanistan, a bomb explosion near a defense ministry building injured at least 65 people, including 9 children, in the capital Kabul today, according to local officials. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the bombing, which was followed by a gun battle with Afghan security forces. The attack comes after a weekend of violence across Afghanistan, and as U.S. and Taliban officials meet for another round of peace talks in Qatar to discuss the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Around 300 people, mostly fighters from both government and Taliban forces, were reported killed over multiple attacks Friday and Saturday. 8 election workers were among those killed in a Taliban attack on a government compound in Kandahar province Sunday. Afghanistan is currently gearing up for a presidential election at the end of September. In Italy, police arrested Carola Ricchetta, the 31-year-old German captain of a refugee rescue ship, Saturday after her vessel collided with an Italian border police boat as she attempted to dock at the Lampedusa port. Ricchetta and 53 refugees were caught in limbo at sea for over 2 weeks in need of medical care and food as authorities refused to let the Sea Watch 3 dock and passengers disembark. This is Ricchetta speaking from aboard the ship the day before she was arrested.
The concerns about these people have really kept me busy day and night, I can assure you, especially also this very frustrating communications with governments which haven't taken responsibility. Then I have 22 crew totals, so 21 apart from me, which are also my responsibility and who have been working very much, who are definitely fatigued, tired, frustrated, and also suffer psychologically from the situations where I have these over 60 people to take care of, and Mr. Salvini might just get in line.
Carola Ricchetta was referring there to Italy's anti-immigrant Interior Minister Matteo Salvini, who refused to let Ricchetta dock her ship and called her actions an act of war. German officials and human rights groups have praised the Sea Watch 3's mission and condemned the Italian government for criminalizing humanitarian aid. The U.S. Senate Friday rejected a measure restricting Trump's ability to go to war with Iran without congressional authorization. The proposal would have retroactively attached an amendment to the $750 billion National Defense Authorization Act, which was passed Thursday 86-8. A similar bipartisan amendment to prevent unapproved military action against Iran was also introduced in the House last week. In an unexpected partnership, liberal billionaire donor George Soros and right-wing billionaire Charles Koch have teamed up to finance a new think tank with the mission of, quote, moving U.S. foreign policy away from endless war and toward vigorous diplomacy in the pursuit of international peace, unquote. The co-founders of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, which launches in September, include Trita Parsi, founder of the National Iranian American Council, and Andrew Basevich, retired colonel and Vietnam War veteran, both outspoken critics of U.S. military and foreign policy. On Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected Alabama's attempt to ban dilation and extraction, the most common second trimester abortion procedure. If allowed to go into effect, the law would have affected 99% of abortions performed after 15 weeks. In May, Alabama signed the nation's most restrictive abortion ban into law, effectively banning the procedure except in cases where a pregnant person's life is at serious risk. That law is currently being challenged in lower courts. In another decision Friday, the Supreme Court agreed to hear an appeal by the Trump administration over its move to end DACA. That's deferred action for childhood arrivals. Four federal appeals courts have since blocked the repeal of DACA, which affects the immigration status of nearly 800,000 formerly undocumented people who were brought to the U.S. as children. The court will hear the case in its upcoming term, which starts in October. A federal judge has barred President Trump from using $2.5 billion in Pentagon funds to build a border wall following his declaration of a national emergency in February. The move by California Judge Haywood Gilliam comes in response to two separate lawsuits and expands his ruling in May that said Trump does not have the authority to circumvent Congress to appropriate the funds required for construction. The ACLU brought one of the suits on behalf of the Sierra Club and the Southern Border Communities Coalition. Gloria Smith, an attorney at the Sierra Club, applauded the decision, saying, quote, walls divide neighborhoods, worsen dangerous flooding, destroy lands and wildlife, and waste resources that should instead be used on the infrastructure these communities truly need, she said. Former New York City police detective and outspoken advocate for 9/11 responders, Luis Alvarez, died on Saturday at the age of 53 after a three-year battle with cancer. Earlier this month, Alvarez spoke before Congress alongside other 9/11 responders and former Daily Show host Jon Stewart, urging lawmakers to extend health care protections for rescue workers like himself who became sick after responding to the September 11, 2001 terror attacks in downtown Manhattan.
This fund is not a ticket to paradise. It is there to provide for our families when we can't. Nothing more. You all said you would never forget. Well, I'm here to make sure that you don't.
The House is expected to vote this month to permanently extend the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told a group of first responders last week the Senate would work to pass its authorization by August. In Virginia, James Fields, a self-described neo-Nazi who killed activist Heather Heyer at an anti-hate rally in 2017, was sentenced Friday to life in prison. Fields plowed his car into a crowd of anti-racist protesters in Charlottesville at a counter-protest of the white supremacist Unite the Right rally. Following the rally and Heyer's killing, President Trump claimed there were very fine people on both sides. Heather Heyer's mother, Susan Breaux, reacted to the verdict.
The last time I saw my daughter was to identify her body and to sign the papers for her to be cremated. And I held her bruised hand and bruised arm, and I said, I'm going to make this count for you. And that's what I've done, and I will continue to do. You don't get to knock my child down and silence that voice without 500 more raising up. Don't get to do that.
Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed a bill Friday requiring formerly incarcerated people with felony convictions to repay all fines and fees to courts before they can vote again. Civil rights groups say the measure is essentially a poll tax. A lawsuit filed by formerly incarcerated people in groups including the ACLU and the NAACP immediately followed his move. Last November, 65% of Florida voters approved Amendment 4, restoring voting rights to 1.4 million people with nonviolent felonies who have fully completed their sentences by overturning a Jim Crow-era law aimed at suppressing the black vote. But Republican lawmakers have been working to stop the measure from being fully implemented. Following the signing of Friday's bill, the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, which led the campaign to pass Amendment 4, announced a new fund to help those with past convictions pay off their fines and fees and help them register to vote via the website wegotthevote.org. You can see our interviews with Desmond Mead, the head of Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, at democracynow.org. 2020 Democratic candidates Beto O'Rourke and Julian Castro headed to Clint, Texas, the immigration jail there, over the weekend, which has come under intense scrutiny over recent reports of inhumane conditions and child neglect. Julian Castro, the former San Antonio mayor and secretary of Housing and Urban Development under President Obama, was denied entry into the Clint Child Jail on Saturday. Former Congressmember O'Rourke participated in a rally in front of the jail Sunday, calling out the dire conditions inside. Both Castro and O'Rourke also recently visited a Homestead, Florida immigration jail, along with other 2020 presidential contenders in town for the first Democratic debate, including Senators Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Bernie Sanders, as well as New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio and South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg. In more news from last week's 2020 Democratic debate, Democrats are condemning Donald Trump Jr. after he retweeted an alt-right personality during Thursday night's debate who attacked Senator Kamala Harris's identity as a Black American, writing, quote, "Kamala Harris is not an American Black. She is half Indian and half Jamaican. I'm so sick of people robbing American Blacks like myself of our history. It's disgusting. Harris's family were actually slave owners," he tweeted. Don Jr. reposted the tweet, adding, "Is this true? Wow." He then deleted the tweet later that night after coming under fire, including from Joe Biden, who clashed with Harris at the debate over his checkered track record on race. Biden tweeted, quote, "The same forces of hatred rooted in birtherism that questioned Barack Obama's American citizenship and even his racial identity are now being used against Senator Kamala Harris," unquote. Birtherism was widely promoted by Donald Trump while he was campaigning for president. 36 Jewish activists were arrested Sunday as they protested, along with hundreds of others, in front of an Immigration and Customs Enforcement immigrant jail in Elizabeth, New Jersey. The protest, organized by Never Again Action, brought together activists from the immigrant community and Jews who called for an immediate end to ICE raids, deportations, and immigrant prisons. And 4 million people took to the streets of New York City Sunday in the largest LGBTQ pride celebration in history. The demonstration was just one of many taking place across the United States and the world this weekend. In some cities, however, events were banned and efforts to mark the occasion were harshly suppressed. In Istanbul, Turkey, clashes broke out between police and members of the LGBT community after the governor banned a planned annual march for the fifth running year. Back in New York City, there were 2 marches to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising that sparked the modern-day LGBTQ movement. Hundreds of thousands marched down Fifth Avenue for the World Pride Parade, surrounded by millions cheering them on. And in Sheridan Square, at the very site where gay and trans people clashed with police on the early morning of June 28, 1969, tens of thousands more gathered for the anti-corporate, anti-police queer liberation march. This is longtime activist and journalist Ann Northrup, host of the free speech TV show Gay USA.
The Heritage of Pride main parade has evolved into a corporate party, and we just think that's ridiculous and insulting and demeaning and disempowering. So we got together to bring the community back into the streets.
We'll have more voices from the Queer Liberation March of tens of thousands later in the broadcast. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump made history this weekend when he became the first sitting U.S. president to step foot in North Korea. Trump met North Korean leader Kim Jong-un at the military demarcation line at the Korean Demilitarized Zone. Kim then invited Trump to cross the line, which has divided North and South Korea since 1953. Trump then took about 20 steps into North Korea. The surprise meeting came 24 hours after Trump tweeted to Kim Jong-un, offering to meet him at the DMZ after the G20 summit wrapped up in Japan. After meeting at the demilitarized zone, Trump and Kim then held a three-way meeting with South Korean President Moon Jae-in. Trump and Kim appeared together at a news conference.
It's just an honor to be with you, and it was an honor that you asked me to step over that line, and I was proud to step over the line. I thought you might do that. I wasn't sure, but I was ready to do it, and I want to thank you. It's been great. It's been great. Very historic. They were just saying, one of the folks from the media was saying, this could be a very historic moment, and I guess that's what it is, but I enjoyed being with you, and thank you very much.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un also addressed reporters.
In fact, I was surprised to see your message that you wanted to meet me in the morning. And then I found that there's been an official offer for today's meeting in the late afternoon. Our great relationship will continue to create good events that others can't expect. I am confident that it will be mystical powers to lead us to overcome all obstacles.
When we come back from break, we'll go to Seoul, South Korea, as well as Hawaii, to get response to this historic meeting. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Music by the South Korean violinist and peace activist Hyung Jun-won. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump made history Sunday when he became the first sitting U.S. president to set foot in North Korea. Sunday marked Trump and Kim Jong-un's first meeting since nuclear talks broke down in February at a Vietnam summit when President Trump walked out. It appears another round of nuclear talks could begin in the coming weeks. The New York Times reports the Trump administration is now considering settling for a nuclear freeze in North Korea after years of demanding full denuclearization. To talk more about Sunday's historic meeting and what it means, we're joined by two guests. From Seoul, South Korea, Susie Kim is with us, associate professor of Korean history at Rutgers University, the author of Everyday Life in the North Korean Revolution, 1945-50. And in Honolulu, Hawaii, Christine Ahn, founder and executive director of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War. Professor Susie Kim in Seoul, you're there in the Koreas when this Sunday moment took place. What was the significance of Donald Trump becoming the first sitting president to step foot in North Korea as he walked with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un?
I feel very fortunate to have been here to be able to witness that on the Korean Peninsula. I think the significance is telling in terms of how the South Korean public responded. I was able to walk around the city center yesterday as this was unfolding, and an interesting kind of convergence happened between both the sort of the left and the right, where traditionally they're polarized, just like in the United States, but both sides in many respects welcomed President Trump. And welcome this opportunity for him to make history by stepping foot in North Korean soil. I think the significance lies in the fact that, on the one hand, it's this border that seemed very impenetrable, but President Trump was able to show his willingness to be able to step across that border, to be able to make a commitment to continue to work towards a peace process on the Korean Peninsula, which was reciprocated by Chairman Kim Jong-un of North Korea. And as significant as that was, what I thought was also quite telling was just how absurd that border really is, just by the sheer kind of ease with which the president and the chairman were able to cross it when there was the political will to do so. And so I think in many respects, while there may be some cynicism coming out from U.S. Sources, I think the public in Korea, their welcoming of President Trump, despite all of his faults, I think is quite telling in terms of the urgency and the need that they feel to continue this peace process forward in Korea.
Mm. And Christine Ahn, who founded Women Cross the DMZ, you have crossed that very line. Here you are now in Honolulu. You are Korean yourself. Can you respond to what quickly unfolded this weekend? Did it surprise you? And what do you think of what happened and where it will lead?
Well, we very much, Susie Kim was also on that journey in 2015 with 30 women peacemakers, including Gloria Steinem and Nobel Peace Laureates. And that's where we did want to cross, but we ended up crossing in Kaesong, which is actually quite symbolic because that was really the development of committed work by the two Korean leaders at that time during the era of the Sunshine Policy to begin the process of integration. And so to see right now Trump cross that border, as Susie said, was, I think, a long-held wish and desire for the Korean people, not just the people in North and South Korea, but obviously Koreans all around the world who have so longed for an end to the Korean War. My friend Hejung Park happened to also note yesterday that it was also the 30th anniversary of Im Soo-young, who was the South Korean university student who went to North Korea at the same day 30 years ago, and she became the first civilian woman to cross the DMZ on her return back to South Korea, and was arrested, of course, and imprisoned for 5 years because of violating the national security law. But, you know, I think what's so significant is that women have really led the way in crossing that DMZ and really showing the kind of absurdity of this man-made militarized border and really the power of what people and social movements can do when, in the case of now, can overthrow a neoconservative leader, Park Geun-hye, a corrupt leader who now sits in prison, and can usher in a leader like Moon Jae-in, who has been the key interlocutor between the U.S. and North Korea in steadily pushing for a peace process towards the ending of the Korean War. And clearly, while the David Sanger piece shows that maybe what the Trump administration settled for was accepting North Korea as a de facto nuclear power, it's a sign that there is really no choice at this point but to pursue a pragmatic approach to diplomacy, that it will have to be a step-by-step approach. We can't expect North Korea to unilaterally disarm at the front end of a process without assuring security guarantees. And so I think it was overall a great day for Koreans on the peninsula and for Americans here at home.
I wanted to turn to some of the Democratic presidential candidates weighing in on Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un on Sunday. Joe Biden's campaign spokesperson tweeted a statement saying, President Trump's coddling of dictators at the expense of American national security and interests in one of the most dangerous ways he's diminishing us on the world stage and subverting our values as a nation. This past week, he yet again fought over Kim Jong-un, to whom he's made numerous concessions for negligible gain. That was Biden. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren tweeted, "Our president shouldn't be squandering American influence on photo ops and exchanging love letters with a ruthless dictator. Instead, we should be dealing with North Korea through principled diplomacy that promotes U.S. security, defends our allies, and upholds human rights." Again, that was Senator Warren. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders addressed the visit on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
The concern here is his incredible inconsistencies. I have no problem with him sitting down with Kim Jong-un in North Korea or any place else. But I don't want it simply to be a photo opportunity. The whole world's media was attracted there. What's going to happen tomorrow and the next day? He has weakened the State Department. If we're going to bring peace to this world, we need a strong State Department. We need to move forward diplomatically, not just do photo opportunities.
So that's Senator Bernie Sanders. Susie Kim, since you are right now in Seoul, South Korea, you're not probably hearing a lot of the responses in the United States. Of course, the opposition party to President Trump, extremely critical, sounds like a war party. But can you respond to what they are each saying about cozying up to a dictator?
Yes, absolutely. So in my previous answer to the question, I had mentioned that there's been an interesting coalition happening between some of the right and the left political wings in South Korea, for example, in welcoming Trump and his efforts for engagement with North Korea. On the other side, there's been also, I think, an interesting convergence happening in the U.S. Between both the conservatives, the traditional conservatives, and the Democrats or the liberals in terms of criticizing Trump for either his unpredictability or for the fact that he's so-called, quote, cozying up to the so-called dictatorships around the world. But what, as I tried to write about this last year when the first summit between Trump and Kim happened, I think what this signals actually is the fact that the American political leadership is quite unaware of the kind of opportunity that this presents for the Korean people. In other words, just simply evaluating Trump as a political calculation is undermining what potential opening Trump could be opening up for the Korean people. That is to say, Trump may have his own interests or calculations for why he is pursuing this kind of tactic with North Korea in particular in this case. It might be for self-aggrandizement, for example, or photo ops, as many of the quotes that you presented just now. But regardless of what his individual interest might be, I think it presents a particular opportunity in this moment where we can actually carry out a concrete peace process. And in that sense, what Senator Bernie Sanders mentioned about the importance of the work ahead after this kind of symbolic opening is really important. And in that, on that note, I think it's important to note and mention that President Trump specifically targeted and asked Stephen Biegun to basically rally the State Department and his staff to pursue detailed negotiations with the North Korean counterparts in order to make the steps, set the foundation for the peace process ahead. And so I think it's important to see this for what it is, which is that it is a symbolic opening and there is a lot of work ahead.
Mm. We said denuclearization talks, but the word denuclearization was not used. Christine, on the New York Times reporting, the Trump administration now considering settling for a nuclear freeze in North Korea after years of demanding full denuclearization. What exactly does that mean?
I think it just means that you need to strike an interim deal where you freeze North Korea's nuclear arsenal so that they, I mean, it's basically what came out of Hanoi, which was North Korea offered to dismantle Yongbyon and also put a moratorium on their nuclear and long-range missile tests. And the Trump administration wanted basically the Libya model, and so that wasn't going to work for North Korea. And the United States, they also, the North Koreans were demanding a partial lifting of the sanctions. So both sides left. And what happened was in April, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un gave a big speech at the Supreme People's Assembly, and he basically set a timetable. He said the U.S. needs to shift its position, basically, and come back to the table with a different stance. Otherwise, you know, we can all conjecture what that means, possibly return back to the fire and fury, which obviously for Trump won't be good for his 2020 bid for president, because he has been basically saying that, well, we have succeeded in a freeze for freeze. North Korea has not been testing long-range missiles or nuclear weapons. So that is a good thing. And I, you know, to be honest, I would agree with Trump in that stance. But I think that, you know, what brought the Trump administration to this moment besides Kim setting the timetable? One, the Libya model just does not work. And it has not succeeded, obviously, in forcing North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. They have really run the line, end of the line, on maximum pressure, you know, forcing North Korea's denuclearization through sanctions. Really depends on China. And the U.S. is now in a trade war with China. And Xi Jinping's visit to China, to North Korea for the first time 10 days ago was clearly a sign that China holds the keys in terms of whether maximum pressure will succeed or not. And clearly, with the mutual defense treaty between China and North Korea, that is not likely to happen. China will, you know, ensure the security guarantee of North Korea. But also, we're seeing a massive humanitarian disaster. You know, the World Food Program and FAO just came out with a major report. 10 million North Koreans are food insecure. 40% of the population are in dire need of food aid. The sanctions are impacting long-term humanitarian aid or operations from conducting its daily operations in North Korea. Medicine is not getting into North Korea because of these sanctions. So it is a PR disaster for the Trump administration. And so they basically, you know, have come out of, they've run out of options. And, you know, this is the most pragmatic approach. Stephen Biegun, who Women Crush DMZ has met with, seems to me very, he's a seasoned diplomat. And I think that it's a good day that he is now charged with leading the working level negotiations with North Korea. His speech at Stanford before the Hanoi summit, which many of us thought was the trajectory that the Trump administration was on, seemed very pragmatic, which seemed very like basically dealing with North Korea as they are, not as we wish them to be. And so, I mean, back to the point about the presidential candidates, I think Sanders obviously chose the most strategic line. Denuclearization talks with North Korea is not going to happen overnight. It's going to be a long-term process. Sig Hecker from Stanford, the nuclear scientist, says it'll take 20 years for North Korea to completely denuclearize. It's going to be a long-term process. The Democrats are shooting themselves in the foot when they say that that they take the moral high ground, that they shouldn't engage North Korea or the evil regime in North Korea, because if they are president, you know, it's going to come back to bite them. And frankly, you know, we should attack Trump not from the right, but from the left. And, you know, calling for a consistent, reliable diplomacy, but also calling for a new approach that doesn't rely on the same failed model of maximum pressure or its predecessor, strategic patience.
Bolton, the national security advisor who was not at Trump's side, was not there in Korea, just tweeted, "I read this New York Times story with curiosity. Neither the NSC, that's the National Security Council staff, nor I have discussed or heard of any desire to settle for a nuclear freeze by North Korea." Susie Kim, if you could respond. And also, before we end, talk about Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, and what this means for him. In South Korea, opposition is very strong, yet he has made this the linchpin of his administration and his goals, bringing together Trump and Kim, the significance of this meeting for him domestically and internationally.
Well, if I could start with the second question, I guess, first. So President Moon Jae-in, as you mentioned, there's been opposition, largely because there's been some debate about what is the best approach with North Korea. I think in some ways very similar to the kind of debates we've seen in the United States. And so for him, I think it's imperative, as it is for President Trump, and perhaps even for Chairman Kim, to be able to deliver on some of the promises that they've made. President Moon has basically said that a peace process in the Korean Peninsula would be a win-win situation where it could open up all kinds of economic opportunities for both Koreas. And I think President Trump has also said similar things in terms of promising North Korea relief from sanctions, that could also end up leading to major economic opportunities for North Korea. And of course, from the North Korean side, that kind of economic opportunity and relief from sanctions is absolutely urgent. As Christine mentioned, there's major devastating effects on the regular North Korean population as a result of the sanctions. And I think the latest that's coming out from humanitarian organizations like the World Food Program or the Red Cross is that, you know, there's again a major weather issues that North Korea is having to deal with that is affecting their total agricultural produce. And so all of this is absolutely important for all political leaders, I think, to be able to make headway, even if it's merely for the survival of their own political careers. It's absolutely important that they see some progress on this, which explains a little bit about why there's been that much effort. Going back to your other question about Bolton, could you remind me again what your question was? I'm sorry.
I asked about Bolton saying he knows nothing about denuclearization, but we have to break. We're going to save that. We have to say he knows nothing about a nuclear freeze, but we're going to move on to that in the coming days. I want to thank Susie Kim, Associate Professor of Korean History at Rutgers University, and Christine Ahn, founder of Women Cross the DMZ. Susie Kim joining us from Seoul, Christine Ahn from Honolulu. When we come back, 4 million people flood the streets of New York City in the largest LGBTQ World Pride celebration in history. Stay with us. Ooh, ooh, I know my head's doing wet. Ooh, ooh, it kissed me on my neck. Ooh, ooh, and to anybody, yeah. A husband of days and nights. Ooh, ooh, and by fire light. And your pretty eyes looking at me so bright. Ooh, ooh, Dress by Corinne Bailey Ray. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 4 million people took to the streets of New York City Sunday in the largest LGBTQ Pride celebration in history. The demonstration, just one of many taking place around the country and the world this weekend. North Macedonia held its first gay pride parade ever Saturday in Paris. Thousands demonstrated in the streets. Trans and gay activists in Istanbul forced to disperse after Turkish police attacked them with tear gas and rubber bullets. This came after the governor there banned a planned annual Pride March for the fifth year running. And in Singapore, activists demanded an end to a law banning gay sex. But back here in New York City, there were actually two marches to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising that sparked the modern-day LGBTQ movement. Revelers marched down Fifth Avenue, cheered on by millions for the World Pride Parade. And in Sheridan Square, at the very site where gay and trans people clashed with police on the early morning of June 28, 1969, tens of thousands of activists gathered for an anti-corporate queer liberation march. Among their chants, Stonewall was a riot. We will not be quiet. Well, Democracy Now!'s Tamarie Astudillo and Libby Rainey were there in the streets. They spoke to some of the activists who were there in the days of the Stonewall Uprising 50 years ago, as well as those who carry on the tradition today. Among them, Raquel Willis, who recently became the first trans woman to be executive editor of Out magazine. But we begin with the veteran activist and journalist Ann Northrup. Among other things, she's co-host of Free Speech TV show Gay USA.
I'm Ann Northrup. I'm one of the organizers of the Queer Liberation March for Reclaim Pride. The point of this march is that we are a people's community political march. And that's what this march used to be when it was invented and for several decades. The Heritage of Pride main parade has evolved into a corporate party. And we just think that's ridiculous and insulting and demeaning and disempowering. So we got together to bring the community back into the streets. That's the whole point of this, bring the community back into the streets and make clear our grievances, our demands for liberation and justice, and to mourn our dead, and certainly to celebrate our victories. A lot of the issues have not changed from 50 years ago. There is still enormous violence perpetrated on our community, certainly trans women of color being murdered on a regular basis now, but still violence against members of our community across the board. Policing. The police are still picking up people on the street for no reason, just because they don't like us, and putting us in jail. Still entrapping gay men all over the place. And non-discrimination. We do not have a national law that protects us from discrimination in housing or employment or public accommodations. And this is going on all over the world, especially as right-wing dictators take power in more and more places, whether it's Brazil or Hungary or the United States of America.
My name is Raquel Willis. I am out here at the Queer Liberation March to be with our radical folks who are really fighting for the things that people like Marsha and Sylvia were fighting for at the original Stonewall Riot. So I'm excited to be here. We're talking about decriminalization. We're talking about ending the violence that our people are facing across different sectors in the world. And so it's important to be here today.
What does it mean to be here 50 years after the Stonewall Uprising? And as you said, people here are making clear that was a riot. So what does it mean to be here, and what does it mean to be building on that history?
I think there's a lot of excitement, but I also think that there's so much left for us to fight for, and that's what we're talking about here at the Queer Liberation March. I think about the ways in which they were fighting against police brutality, fighting against all of the state violence that was being faced, and how we still got to keep that fight up. I mean, we've lost so many black and brown trans sisters this year, this month alone, at least four or five. And so it's important for us to continue that fight and lift up the real legacy that happened on that fateful night in June 1969.
And what's your message for corporations, for New York City? I mean, you know, this march is taking place in the heart of Manhattan just weeks after Lailene Polanco was found dead in a cell at Rikers Island.
Right. Well, I think that we have to be very strategic about where the dollars are being placed in the different efforts in our community. If you're not prioritizing the lives of black and brown folks, all your other fights don't really matter, because what are we fighting for if the people are not here to enjoy this world that we want to see so very much liberated? I think the other part of that too is that we have so much visibility now, and that is a great thing, but we've got to move beyond visibility to focusing on vitality and how we can keep folks alive, and also crafting a new vision of liberation for these next 50 years. Because when the glitter settles, the crowds are gone, people are putting up their rainbow flags, what are we going to be doing on July 1st moving forward?
My name is Sophia, and I'm here because I don't want to attend World Pride because of the corporate neoliberalism that's going on. So I think it's important to have another event beside World Pride and beside Pride in New York to liberate the queers and to honor Stonewall 50.
Your sign says trans rights now, and on the other side it says abolish ICE. Tell me about that.
Well, recent events just showed me that it's very important to not stand up for queer rights, but trans rights in general. Because of the military ban, and there have been 14 trans women killed in the U.S. since January, and it's very important to honor that. And to honor the fact that black trans women are the women that get killed on a daily basis and no one is investigating in it. So that's what a sign is about.
This march is taking place on the 50th anniversary of Stonewall, or just a day or two after. What does it feel like to be out here today 50 years later?
Well, it feels very, I'm very proud and very honored to be here because obviously I didn't experience Stonewall myself, so it's very important to honor Marsha and all the black trans women, what they did for us, and 50 years later nothing changed, so we still have to fight for the rights they did.
My name is Jay Toole, I'm 71 years old, I'm a butch, and I'm out here with Reclaim Pride, Queer Liberation March, because I can't stand the corporations anymore, or the cops. And it's been 50 years, and it's time we go right back to our roots. The night of Stonewall riots, I was homeless, a kid, and sleeping in Washington Square Park. And news filtered down to the park because the village was much different. You know, word spread like wildfire. It was our cell phones. And we all rushed up this way, you know, and the place was packed. You know, everybody was out here, hundreds of people. And they had arrested the guys already, you know, and when I got here, they were pushing us down towards the women's prison, which was on Greenwich Avenue and Christopher. And a lot of them came around the building, the Northern Dispensary, very short building. So it ended up being us, the cops, us, and people were throwing things and setting garbage cans on fire. The Stonewall window was smashed by a garbage can. You know, and then they called in the TPs, which is the Tactical Police Force, and they actually had shotguns and billy clubs, and it was exciting. You know, it was time for us to push back, and we all came together to do that. This year, you know, the Queer Liberation March, what it means to me is, it is a liberation. You know, it's us coming together and saying no to everything that the parade does. You know, I've never called it a parade. You know, it's a parade is for people that have all their rights. I'm still fighting, I'm still marching. So today is really big for me to get back to where we started from and bringing everybody in this time and not leaving anybody behind. You know, a lot of people were left behind in the other movements.
Hey, hey! Ho, ho! Cops at Pride have got to go! Hey, hey! Ho, ho! Cops at Pride have got to go! My name is Chanel Elaine, and we are honoring, first we are honoring our ancestors in the fight for liberation who started this all 50 years ago at the Stonewall Bar.
You're chanting, hey ho, cops at Pride have got to go. Why is that such a crucial part of what this march is all about?
Well, first of all, because the march is about love, and it's about equality and about liberation. And cops kill people every day. Black, brown, gay, lesbian, trans, black women, and they don't care about our lives or our body. They do not protect us. We do not see them as a safety net.
My name is Brianna. I'm out here today with ACT UP. We're a group of people that act together to fight for AIDS awareness and AIDS treatment. So today we're representing the 17 people who have died in ICE custody that were HIV positive or had AIDS. No one should be in ICE custody, but it's especially heinous that ICE is they're not giving people the proper medication that they need, so they're dying, and it's all under our government. People should be outraged about it.
My name is Alma Rosa Silva Bañuelos. I'm coming from Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm Two-Spirit Mexica Azteca, and I am here to bring Two-Spirit medicine to the Queer Liberation March. Currently, I'm working to support trans asylum seekers. The unfortunate part is that transphobia is rampant in different countries, and the violence towards our trans community is incredibly intense. And so our family, our relatives are fleeing for their lives. This is not just because there's some kind of discrimination. Their lives are being threatened, their friends are being murdered and killed, and they have to leave. If not, it's their life. And right now we're working to free Alejandra Barrera, who's from El Salvador, 20-year trans activist that was threatened and had to leave her country. She's been detained for 2 years now, and we are asking ICE to release her. We are asking that she be able to be released from detention so she can fight her case from the outside.
I'm Leslie Kagan. I'm part of the core organizing team from Reclaim Pride. I'm part of this effort because not only am I a lesbian for many, many years, and not only do I know that the fight of the queer communities, and there are many subsections of our community, not only are those fights far from over, but we're also at a critical moment in the history of this community and so many other communities that we must find a way to bring a greater cohesion and unity to our struggles. So today, we are all about lifting the notion of liberation, that it's not, that equality is not enough, acceptance is not enough, being integrated into the norms and the structures of this society is far from enough. What we need to do is to be a strong enough movement, a queer movement, a diverse movement, a movement connected to other movements, strong enough to actually challenge the institutions and the structures that so rigidly define all of our lives.
I'm Tiana. I'm out here because I've been coming to Pride since I was 13. My parents brought me, and it's always where I felt like home. It's always where I felt like myself, you know, being surrounded by all of these people. It's just, it's a magical day. It's amazing. Just be able to fight for our rights. I mean, it's ridiculous that we still have to do this, but at the same time, it's just nice to be able to gather together and be together.
What's your message to people, groups like Bank of America or Google that, you know, have the rainbow flag, but maybe don't have the politics to back it up?
Yeah, just do better. I mean, if you're going to show that you're full of pride, then actually be full of pride. You know, start hiring trans and queer, and no more discrimination, no more sexism, no more transphobia. You know, it's all of it's ridiculous that we still have to fight for this, but at the same time, it's just like they need to wake up and realize that our march is not for their advertisement. It's not for them to make money. It's because this is what we need. We need more. We need justice.
I'm Ozzy. I'm with CGay, LGBTQ Filipinos. I'm out here today really protesting in regards to queer liberation, especially in the Philippines because of the increase of human rights violations that's going on there. The people are frustrated that we aren't able to get the necessary basic needs met. And the fact that the government and like the corporations are complicit to it, and like we're tired of it, and it's time that we stand up and voice that. And we're going to continue marching until we are all free.
My name is Nora. I came in all the way from Chicago. I'm here mainly for the 50th anniversary of Stonewall to pay my respects, but I'm also here to march against the corporatization of Pride and the police presence that is in contemporary Pride Fests these days.
Your sign says affordable housing for all, hashtag Pride. Talk about how this march is engaging with all these issues, affordable housing, abolishing ICE.
Well, I've seen multiple signs for all different kinds of issues. There's one for intersex justice right there. There's some for abolishing ICE. There's one for keeping the police out of Pride. All these issues do, in fact, harm queer people, including and especially housing, because a disproportionate amount of LGBT youth are dealing with housing insecurity due to lack of family support that they would otherwise be able to stay at a mother or aunt's place. And it's really frustrating to see it. So many of my friends have to go through with it.
My name is Martha Shelley, and I was one of the people who started the Gay Liberation Front like within 1 week after the Stonewall riot, and we had our first protest march exactly 1 month after Stonewall, and there were about 400 people who showed up. For most of them, it was the first time they had been gay in public.
What does it mean to you to be here today, 50 years later?
It is essentially the spirit that we had then, anti-corporate, anti-war, for liberation for all people. And the most important thing for us at that time was the right to control your own body, the right to have sex with the people of your choice, the right to ingest the drugs of your choice without being thrown in prison, the right not to have your ass drafted and shipped off to Vietnam, and of course, equal rights for everybody regardless of their color or ethnicity or religion. Those rights are starting to be rolled back by the current administration. And we have to fight that. We have to fight to save the planet. because if there's a, you know, if we have a hot, uninhabitable planet, what good are our rights?
Gay Liberation Front founder and Lavender Menace member Martha Shelley, who was there 50 years ago today in the aftermath of the Stonewall Uprising. The Queer Liberation March kicked off at 9:30 in the morning Sunday. Between it and the World Pride March, 4 million people gathered in the streets of New York. The Pride March ended after midnight, the largest LGBTQ.
Want to advertise?